What's up, Kevin?
Hey, Tara.
I went first this time.
I know. Congratulations.
Thank you.
How are you?
Good.
Yeah?
Yeah.
We're recording on not the typical night when we record.
We're on a Monday.
I know. For a very good reason.
Oh, Kevin's going to LA.
No, that's not why. That's not why at all. Because of our special guest.
That's true.
Who's
oh,
in the
yeah.
building,
he's only
is in
town
Chicago
tonight.
And typically, obviously, the corner store is Chicago centered, but we also rock with peoples from all over, particularly when they're popping.
Okay.
And right. obviously, we think Chicago
that
is
really bad. I don't know if that's a good look for us.
No, what?
We only want you if you're
popping.
Yeah.
I think that's the move. Why?
Anyway, never
mind. I think that we value everyone, and but we know that Chicago, but we know that Chicago is the center of the universe,
right?
But you have made such an impact in culture that we also recognize it and are super excited to talk to you. So, our guest, I'm going to read the formal bio, and then I'm also reading from his brand new-ish beautiful book. So look, we have
brand
a poet.
New-ish.
Yeah, brand newish. We have a poet, an essayist, a cultural critic from Columbus, Ohio, in the building. His poetry has been published in Muzzle, Vinyl, Pen, America, and multiple other journals and places. Essays and music criticism has been published before in The Fader, Pitchfork, New York Times, MTV News, where he is a columnist. His first full-length poetry collection, The Crown Ain't Worth Much, was published in 2016 and was named as a finalist for the Hurston Wright Award for Poetry. The book that I'm holding in my hand is an incredible collection of essays called They Can't Kill Us Until They Kill Us. And these are essays from our guest here this evening, who really puts on very heavy as well for, like, I think people in music and in, you know, the culture of literature. I think, like, reps for multiple communities of writers in really profound and important ways. So without further ado, y'all, in the corner store tonight, we have Hanif Abdul-Raqib.
Hey, y'all. There's a couple past tense things in my bio.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
I'm
you want to correct them?
MTV News, but, like, it was great.
Yeah.
Had a great run.
You had a great run?
Mm. Great run.
Well, we'll get there. We're going to ask you about all of it. But before we begin officially with the inquiry, we do have some gifts for you.
Yes. We have to welcome you officially into the corner store.
Yeah. So, and, you know, you feel free to do what you wish with these. If you want to, get into them now, please feel free. If you want to share with them, you know, we have very special guests in the building.
Our favorite,
yes,
Jessica Hopper
is in the building.
I did not. I'm so excited that Jessica's here, by the way.
So we love
also
her.
Also, Kevin, you have that app on your phone with the noises.
Oh, I know. You're right. Effects. I should use them. So we have, first of all, we have a bag of Lay's Flaming Hot potato chips for you.
Oh, Flaming Hot joints.
Yeah. So
how hot are these? Does anyone remember hers Red Hot chips?
Yeah.
Those were like real
real hot.
I've never had
those
the Lay's.
Those are light.
Hot,
those are light.
These are light. This is light.
Especially the Lay's
hot
one. I don't know how you feel about these, but when I saw these, I got very excited. Tara could attest to this. We were in the corner store off Damon in the division.
Like,
I was like, oh dang, they got Hostess Ding Dongs in the building. I don't know if you even.
You like screams.
I don't really rock with these, but
that's fair.
I'm going to rock with them tonight.
Okay,
can I open these?
You do your thing.
We like sound effects, so you can just get up in the mic.
I haven't really eaten anything like this in a long time.
That's fair.
But, like, it's just pretty much just like a cake. It's just like
it's like a zebra cake without the zebra, would say. Is that?
So I'm on book tour right now, and I've been trying to, like, watch my, like,
you're right.
You know, because I don't have time to go to the gym when I'm on tour. I'm trying to watch what I'm, you know, like, what I'm putting in my body. But tonight's
we are a cheat day at the corner store. And then we also got you a Jarritos Mandarin natural flavor soda with real sugar. Yeah. Now, we do need a bottle opener. That was the one fail.
You can't, like, twist this joint.
I mean,
no, you cannot.
You cannot. I don't know. You cannot. But maybe
somebody have something on their keys.
Maybe super producer DJ Cashier might be able to help.
A lighter. Who's like...
We're going to figure it out by
There's
the time.
There's so many hood methods to open these joints.
There are. And we could bust it on the bottom.
How do y'all not have
you could just smash it.
In the, That is the move right there. I don't know. Look, we are we are at WGN Radio Studios, and we are...
It's not our spaceship to break.
No. We respect the spaceship, even though we're moving.
This brings back memories.
Yeah, right?
When I was young, I couldn't, like, afford stuff like this in my lunch. Like, my parents couldn't afford it. So I would mow lawns and then just fill my lunchbox with junk food like Ding Dongs and like little Debbie cakes. So thank you for the memories.
No, of course. That's in part why I got them, not because of your memories, but my own. But I figured maybe you had some sort of nostalgic take on the Ding Dong.
I can't wait. I can't wait to eat all this on the plane tomorrow morning.
Well,
hopefully someone on the plane has a.
we're gonna try to rectify your hurry toast
situation.
If you're on
that 6 a.m. flight back to Columbus,
right? Get at them. Get at them. Bring that.
Maybe have a more nutritional breakfast than that, though.
You know, so let's go. But so, are you from Columbus?
I'm from Columbus, Ohio.
Okay, and you're from the east side of Columbus. Specifically,
yes, very specific.
And what's it like on the east side of Columbus, Ohio? Also, Midwest in the building. I love the Midwest.
Yes.
Yeah.
So I'm from an area that is kind of interesting right now and always because it sits at the edge of two suburbs, one being Whitehall, one being Bexley, and they both kind of fold in on the area. But right now, the east side of Columbus, or the part of it where I'm from, there's a lot of older Black families. You know, it's almost like an enclave that is untouched by the city sprawl at the moment. And that's really refreshing in a lot of ways. Like, I grew up across the street from a park in Wahoop. Shout out to Scottwood Elementary School. And I'm from a spot where a lot of, like, basketball legends came out. You know what I mean? Or, like, the kind of basketball legends that, you know, the hood has. You know, you get the high school legends who don't make it beyond.
Yeah.
But, you know, I learned to play basketball there.
And Columbus is already a fairly serious sports town, if that's fair
to
say.
There's a football team there.
Right, I've heard of them.
There's a college football team.
Okay, yeah.
I mean, Ohio in general is like a big football state. But
you played, but you hooped?
I hooped and I played soccer.
Okay.
I played soccer for a bit in college and do not play soccer anymore.
You still hoop?
Every now and then.
Are you nice, though?
Thank you.
I'm all right. Yeah, I'm okay. But
that's where I was going. Tara knows.
Exceptionally good. I'm very good. So I'm one of those people who I think my most prominent skills weren't very useful when I was younger and playing pickup. But now everyone wants my most prominent skills because I am very good at not turning the ball over and finding people when they're open.
Oh.
That's kind of it.
You're a true one. Oh, you don't? Okay.
Yeah, I'm a true one. I don't play defense.
Okay. Yeah.
I have gone from like pretending to play defense to no longer even not even faking it. There's no need to play defense. I mean, there's a real need to play defense. If you're a young basketball player
listening to this,
if it's your
do
job,
not
maybe.
Take
play defense.
Hoop advice from Hanif.
If you're like, you know, if you're me,
you're good. Yeah.
If someone if someone gets by me, there should be help at the rim.
You would think. You would hope.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's fair.
So I'm very good at like kind of getting in a defensive stance and then like yelling out help and like looking over my shoulder.
That's good. That's important. You're also notifying your other teammates. That's lovely.
Also, you can ask for help.
See?
Sometimes
I'm not too proud to ask for help.
Life lesson.
So I'm probably actually the best defender if you think about it. The only good defender has ever lived.
If anybody even talks about basketball, Kevin asks if they're nice or not. So, yeah.
I think I'm better than a couple Chicagoans I know who I won't name.
Ooh.
Some of my peers in the writing
community. Yeah. Okay, That's fair. I will say that I'm not one of them because I know I could take you. But the point is
Kevin played professionally in Wales.
Okay, in Wales semi-professional.
You played in Wales?
In the mid-90s, which doesn't say a lot about my game. It does say a lot more about the condition of ball in Wales at the time. But
dominating Wales?
Also, Kevin's I'm secretly super nice.
Yeah,
Do you have a nickname like the Welsh sensation?
No, because I was American. But I don't think I had a nickname. At least they never told me it.
What position did you play
in Wales? I was a one.
In Wales, you were a one.
Yeah, which gives you a sense because in real life I'm probably a three.
Yeah,
because I did play defense. I know
so
this
it's
is
like it's like how a currency is exchanged. You're just like
exactly. Exactly. Exchange. Yeah, I was. Yeah, had greater value in Wales certainly. Yeah,
because of your height.
No. Just because of I played organized ball so much, but that's not here or there. So in Columbus,
move on to a topic I know something about?
So you said you were able to play ball outside. Like what did your parents do?
My mother passed when I was a teenager. My mother passed when I was 13, but she worked for the Government Defense Center has a hub in Columbus, and my mother worked for there. And my father worked for the Department of Corrections for the state. They moved from New York when I was young, or before I was born. Like, I was born in Ohio, Columbus, but my siblings were born in New York. Me and my brother, who's closest to my age, were both born in Columbus, but my other siblings were born in New York. And my parents moved to, converted to Islam, moved to Columbus because there were job opportunities there in the late 70s, you know, that there weren't elsewhere. And it was between Columbus, if I remember the story correctly, they were balancing between Columbus and Providence, Rhode Island. And I love Providence. Shout out to Providence. But
it's great. It's a great town.
It's a great town.
I've never really been there.
No, it's a really, it's good.
Actually, yeah. I don't think
Providence is kind of like Columbus in the Northeast.
Okay.
I lived in the Northeast for 2.5 years.
I don't know if I've been to Columbus. I've been to Cincinnati.
We got to travel to Providence to interview Trisha Rose. She's in Providence. I love Trisha Rose.
Yeah.
Professor Trisha
Skyline
Rose.
Chili? That's Cincinnati, though, right?
Skyline Chili is Cincinnati. Cincinnati. Skyline Chili is very bad.
Oh, okay. I've never
well,
had
in
it.
My
it's
opinion,
literally
a lot of
only...
Ohioans love it.
Mm.
I don't love it. I don't rock with Skyline Chili.
Can I ask why your
yes.
parents converted to Islam?
I wish I knew.
Oh, okay.
I think there was a point, though, where like a lot of Black people on the East Coast were converting, right? And I think that like a lot of folks converted into the nation, and then some like split off into that. And I think it was just kind of the wave, you know.
So
and I don't mean to be dismissive of the of the like you know of anyone's faith, but I think there was a moment where it was kind of the wave.
And they and you grew up, they were a part of the Nation of Islam.
They were not.
Okay,
they were Sunni Muslims. Still are. My dad still. I mean, my family is still like firmly practicing. I don't know if these are like haram, surely.
No, I checked.
There's not?
Yeah, they're not.
Oh, because most hostess joints, like back in the day, couldn't eat them.
Yeah. There's not.
Not gelatin in them?
Shout out
to you for doing that.
Well, yeah, I you know, kosher, halal, you know,
yeah,
halal,
you know, I mean,
it's close
it's
enough.
It's very close enough.
Anyway,
you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because I was like, damn, like these joints, I mean, I'm still gonna eat them, you know? Like,
oh, yeah.
I would not purposely have you out here.
Hang
you
me
know?
Out to dry.
With the haram. You know
me,
what I mean?
Put you on blast.
I mean,
gelatin.
I've done several haram things this week, and it's only Monday, so you know. Like,
that's fair.
Eating the hostess is not the worst.
Well, growing up Muslim in Columbus, Ohio, I mean, to me that seems like an anomaly. I might be wrong. I don't really know Columbus, Ohio like that. So I guess what was it like? I mean, first of all, how big is the family when you say siblings?
I have three siblings.
Okay.
I have two brothers and a sister, both parents. So the family was like, I think looking back now, because I know so many people who grew up as like only children or children with only one other sibling. And growing up, a lot of my friends had that makeup. So my family seemed a lot larger than it perhaps actually was. You know, I remember feeling like my family's really big, but also the way my family was set up, there are like two sets of children, right? Like my brother and I are about 17 months apart, and my two older siblings are about 17 months apart, but I am like 10 years apart from my oldest sibling.
Oh.
Right? And so it's kind of like two sets of children, so you get to kind of live
two different lives,
right? By the time my brother and I were really active in the world, my two older siblings were in college, you know? So we were kind of our own best friends in a way.
That's sweet.
Yeah, it's kind of cool. I don't know if my parents like planned it that way, but I think that's just kind of how it worked out.
Are you tied with your older siblings?
Yeah, a bit, you know. But it's also different, I think, like growing up with that big of an age difference between you, right? You're in different places in the world.
Yeah.
As you know, like my oldest brother, like I had a kid when I was still, you know, a teenager.
Mm.
And so it just is a very different world to exist in and see yourself in. But growing up Muslim in Columbus was fine. There was a distinct difference, of course, pre-9/11 and post-9/11, which I don't think I fully registered until years later, right? Or at least the way I registered it years later was kind of jarring. I think post-9/11, to be a Muslim sometimes meant apologizing or, like, signaling that you are, quote, one of the good ones, and you don't even... I was talking to someone about this recently, how you did that for years without even realizing that you were doing it, right? Because so much of the media was telling you to do it or telling you that you needed to do it or like to offer some kind of penance. And so I think that my life became there's a thing about not being aware of the space you're taking up and then being intimately aware of the space you're taking up and how that can just shift overnight. And I think that kind of happened.
Yeah. So were you pretty devout? Like your family is pretty devout?
My family's both pretty devout and kind of not. Mm-hmm. A weird thing about me is, so I recently watched the movie The Big Sick, which is like fine or whatever. But there's a scene in The Big Sick where a man is like, I'm going to go downstairs and make salat. I'm going to go downstairs and make prayer. And instead, he, like, lays out the prayer rug and like, sits on a chair and plays games on his phone for five. He, like, sets a timer and then plays games for 5 minutes and then, like, rolls up the prayer rug and goes upstairs. And that was kind of me. You know, for some reason, the work of praying five times a day seemed so unreasonable to me, which is odd. Right, I think there's a blessing in being able to pray five times a day and being able to be forgiven five times a day for whatever sins you commit in these in-between times. But I also think that when you're like 13 or 14 and it's nice outside,
it's like the last thing you want to do.
And yeah, it feels like labor. But I don't know. I sometimes think that the act of prayer should be a type of labor that, you know, that we are receiving something in return for. But I also think that it's hard to explain that to a teenager. You know,
wait, can I tell you a story, though?
Yes.
So I used to live at Fullerton, Sacramento, in Logan, and I would walk, like, there's like a parking lot next to me, and I would walk along the alley behind the lot. And one time I was walking to get to like Milwaukee, and there was a car in the lot, and this guy was like, had a piece of cardboard out, and he was like kneeling on it, and I'm like, what is he doing? And then I realized he was praying, and it was, I was like, whoa. It was kind of a beautiful moment, but, you know, I didn't really, it didn't register at first, like, what he was doing. It looked kind of weird, but then I realized, you know.
I mean, ideally.
And he had a piece of cardboard, though. He didn't have a rug, so it didn't, you know, click.
Right. If you're, like, deeply devout, the prayer is the thing you do. Everything stops, right?
Yeah,
I remember going
right.
on family trips, on road trips, and we would have to stop and pull over on the side of the road and pray in the car. One thing that my family did was, you know, oftentimes we were left to our own devices with prayer, but the evening prayer, Maghrib, where you pray when the sun sets, my family would make that together just all the time, because that was the prayer that was at the time when my parents would be home. Mm. Parents would come home from work and we'd all make Maghrib together and then eat. Mm. And so I do, even now as an adult, find myself when the sun is setting kind of having that prayer shaped hole in my heart or whatever. But I'm less devout. I still
fast?
Do Ramadan. I still fast. I don't know why that's the thing that I've decided I'm going to keep doing.
I feel like I have a lot of friends who still do that, who don't, you know, follow a lot of things, but they do that.
It's, you know what I mean? Like, it's so, there's something about the rigor of it.
It is intense.
That is cleansing in a way.
And even I want to do it. I had all these friends in New York who were doing it. I was like, you know, they're all like from Bangladesh or Pakistani or whatever.
Maybe wait until it cycles past the summer. I was talking to a homie the other day, and he was like, I'm trying to do Ramadan with you. I was like, fam, like, wait a couple of years, you know, it'll be in like daylight savings time to hit it.
Right.
And you're only not eating for like 6 hours, you'll be good.
Yeah.
Like, summer months are a little tricky.
It also seems like the call. I feel like and I think that's one of the things about getting, you know, older and maybe more mature, is that, you know, you realize, like, what are your rituals individually and collectively as a family or as a culture, as a religion. And so a lot of times you're pulled or called back also to what you know. I mean, you said, you know, that hole that exists for you is also the space that you know. I mean,
right. Yeah, the poet Ivy Francis talks about exiting a poem. So many poets talk about how to enter a poem and how to enter blah, 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 all this. I mean, I'm not trying to be dismissive of that talk. That's important too. But Ivy Francis talks about, how do you exit a poem and find yourself after you've had a poem leave the body, which is an experience that is sometimes jarring and sometimes horrific and sometimes joyful, but also draining. And so I often think about my rituals. The few religious rituals I have are my way of stepping out of the poem that is my current life and finding some small tethering bit.
Mm.
Yeah, that's pretty.
Yeah.
So, you know, as a younger person, you're playing ball. You're Muslim in Columbus. When did the creative spark begin to enter? How did it begin to take shape for you? Was it through music, or how was it?
Yeah, I was always super interested in music, and like finding ways to talk about music. And I think back now and realize that I did not have a lot of people to talk about music with. And I grew up in a household where music was always present. But there wasn't a lot of dialogue around it. Even though, you know, my oldest brother used to VHS tape Yo MTV Raps and Headbangers Ball. And so, and Rap City, you know, to a lesser extent. Not because it was a worse show, but like,
he wasn't checking for that in the same way.
Shout out to Joe Clare, you know.
Always.
A legend. But, so I remember like watching all of these tapes And I remember feeling things about music that I couldn't find a language for, and also not having anyone to bounce those things off of.
Even your siblings?
Even my siblings who were deeply into music. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I was the youngest of, I'm the youngest of four, and when I had an interest in these things, I would still be coming across as an annoying little brother, I think, in any sense. And
what were you drawn to? I mean, was it fluid between your MTV Raps and Headbangers Ball, or were you, I mean, and who were some of the artists that kind of, you know, got you into feeling like you wanted to begin to find language for it?
Yeah, I was really into the native tongues, and particularly De La Soul, because I thought they were so weird. I remember listening to De La Soul Is Dead when I was young, and De La Soul Is Dead has those skits that run through it.
Where he just said that. He's like, I don't fuck with skits unless it's De La Soul.
De La Soul Is Dead has like a storybook inside of it.
That's right.
I was like super young when I heard that album, and I thought it was so weird.
So weird.
It was just like, and I think by that time, like by the time De La Soul Is Dead came out, like native tongues had begun to splinter. But I was super into De La, and I was super into the short-lived leaders of the new school.
Sure.
Because, and weirdly, I think a thing with me, and I'm thinking about this as I write about rap more now, as I research and write about rap, I always loved the cat in the group who, like, wasn't the... So, leaders of the new school, I was never drawn to Busta Rhymes.
Mm. No shots.
Really... No. I mean, I love... I mean, obviously, yeah, like, Busta Rhymes.
Yeah. He's a star.
Yeah, he's, like, the star of the group.
But...
I love Charlie Brown, you know what I mean? Like, yeah. I love, like, the weird... I actually just watched the video. Do you remember when they broke up on like Yo MTV Raps? They broke up on air.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
No, I didn't.
And I was like, and I had this thing. Sometimes because I watched all these things when I was younger, I think that I imagined them. And so the other day I was like, I don't think Leaders of the New School really broke up on air, but maybe they did. And I like Googled it because YouTube is an infinite resource. And yes, like it's right there. You know what I mean? So I love them. But I also kind of like, really found myself drawn to Ice Cube, who I felt, you know, N.W.A. was like a little bit before. I did not live through N.W.A., right? Or at least in their like most iconic form. I got the N.W.A. that was like cubeless and like.
And when did you come into Cube?
I came into Cube around like 91, 92.
Okay.
So 91, 92 is kind of where I was finding my taste,
yeah.
Right? From like 91 to like 94, I think, is where my taste was first defined.
Death Certificate Cube. Yeah. Which is one of the best, I think, albums front to back of all time.
And I really loved, even though I didn't know who they were back then by name, I really loved like the Bomb Squad. So I loved rap. I remember myself first loving rap like before the sample rules got introduced, you know what I mean? Because you had stuff happening that now is like an unfathomable, right? Like on like Nation of Millions, A Fear of a Black Planet, you have songs that have like 30 samples.
Couldn't make that record now.
You can't make that. It's just too expensive, or it would be impossible. Impossible. Right. And so all of these things really defined my taste, and I was fascinated by West Coast hip hop, but did not love it. I didn't consider Cube a West Coast MC, even though obviously he isn't a very West Coast MC, but those solo albums felt, especially the first one.
Well, it was made in New York.
Made with New York producers.
With the Bomb Squad.
So it felt very East Coast.
Yeah.
And so I remember when The Chronic came out, I felt like I couldn't relate to it, but I wanted to, you know?
Yeah.
I wanted to, like, I think The Chronic is one of those first albums that made a sound so atmospheric that you couldn't help but visualize the coast it was made in. You know, I remember listening to that album in the winter. It came out in, like, I think the fall. And I remember listening to it in the winter and being like, wow. Like, I feel like there's sand and there's beaches. And
I feel warmer.
You know what I mean? And that album shifted the culture in Columbus. You have people like, you can't put, like, Daytons and chrome wheels on cars in Columbus, you know, because the weather's too unpredictable and, like, no one's going to drop their top. You know, I mean, people were doing it just because, you know?
Yeah.
And I remember finding a kind of love for better or worse, for Dr. Dre, though mostly because he, with The Chronic, seemed to, like, do a lot of work to introduce new West Coast rappers. Like, he built kind of a blueprint for West Coast rap. I wasn't that into Snoop, but, like, I appreciated Snoop.
Not even, like,
not from
on
Jump.
The... Yeah.
I mean, I grew up in the Midwest, but I had a strong East Coast rap bias. My older brothers and my older sister, like, really loved, you know, East Coast rap was it, you know, and, like, the weirder East Coast rap by that point, too, like, J.Rue and, like, once Wu-Tang hit and, like, you know, so...
So good,
in the early mid-90s, it was hard for me to get into West Coast rap except for, like... think when Farsight came along, I was kind of into him, like the Coop, you know, I was like into those cats, but like
Farsight a little more recognizable. If you liked Native Tongues, you might be more obliged to like the Farsight.
I mean, they were one of the West Coast rappers that didn't feel like West Coast rappers to me, and Snoop felt very West Coast,
sure,
whereas someone like Corrupt didn't, you know, like I liked the Dog Pound because I thought Corrupt was sonically malleable as an MC, which I think he like proved on his solo stuff, where he kind of like bridged on production with production, was like rapping over all kinds of stuff.
So you're listening, and you're listening with siblings, onto yourself, with homies. Are you also finding a community outside of your, you know, family in order to build and share ideas with, or not yet?
Not yet. I kind of thought, I just wrote about this recently, I don't think I started discovering new music and excitedly discovering new music until like Napster. Shout out to Napster. Because I felt like I was like defining my tastes. But like there was a whole world outside of
LimeWire. Shout out to LimeWire. That's how I found music.
I know. That's not that old.
Because you had to download whole albums.
Yeah, right?
Like you had to listen. Yeah.
I mean, you could download just tracks, obviously. But if you wanted to be efficient, because either way, you're going to be waiting like a day.
Yeah. You got to download everything.
What y'all
like,
know about that?
Ethically.
What y'all know about that?
Yeah. I mean, back then, like late 90s, early 2000s, you're going to be waiting like a day to download everything. So why not download? I remember I downloaded. I'd heard this record before but didn't latch onto it. I downloaded Songs in the Key of Life, like the whole joint on Napster. It took like 3 days because it's like, that's a banger, you know what I mean? It's like a couple albums. And I remember like,
you download like five albums at once and you just like sit there and wait.
And you couldn't, like, if you downloaded a whole album file, you couldn't skip tracks. You had to listen to the whole thing. And so I remember like putting that on and hearing the first notes of Love's a Needle, Love to Dan, being like, this is the best thing I've ever heard in my life. You know what I mean?
So that's where you found your community, through an online format.
Yeah, I'm like one of those cats who grew up and like found, if you think about like Napster was the first social media, where if we were to believe that like people's record collections are in
forums?
Their case, no, not okay. on Napster. It was just like straight up, you log in and take music.
Yeah, okay. Illegally.
But if we're to believe that people's like collections and their tastes define who they are as people, you know, there's something about having access to someone's entire record collection and having them say like, I want you to share this with you, and then you being tasked with then sharing it with your people, whoever your people may be, and you don't even know who your people are, but they're taking your music too.
But that's when you got in trouble, right? Later with the peer-to-peer.
It wowed out. People were super nervous. I remember like being like cats I was in school with, being like, I gotta go home and delete all my fun.
I know, because they coming for you, but I didn't know who it was.
Yeah,
so
no one
you're
knew.
Just going to turn the peer-to-peer
fear
off.
Tactic too,
yeah.
Right? I mean,
yeah. It was like straight up FBI fear tactic.
Yeah.
So, but when did you begin to then turn? I think hip-hop does this with a lot of young creatives, and you know, you take an interest and then you make that creative turn because the culture is also giving you permission in order to do something.
I became super interested in tracking down samples. I don't know what sparked this interest, and I don't even remember what album did it. I think it was Pete Rock's Soul Survivor, maybe.
Yeah.
And I got super hype off that album.
Yeah.
And I got super interested in just tracking down samples. And that began a project where I found myself like tracking down samples from everywhere, like old Tribe albums. And like, and what that did to me was like, it
you started
up.
To dig, but yeah. How did you, were you reading liner notes? If you were getting it online? Oh yeah.
I love liner notes. I still obsess over liner notes. I am upset that the album as a format is less prominent, because liner notes were great. Liner notes to me, my brother used to get cassette tapes. He was kind of, we were in that weird phase where it's like, because like CDs weren't that big yet, but like cassettes were still in. And cassettes,
how old is your brother?
My oldest brother is 34.
Okay.
So he was, or 44, I'm sorry. And so he was getting cassette tapes. And I would always, like every Tuesday, you know, open the joints
every
up.
Tuesday, right?
Yeah,
because that's like when they came to the record store.
Yeah,
and that's when I would go to like Soul City was the local record shop, and I get like the new.
There was
the
a
new
reason
shits.
Why I don't remember why.
I don't. Yeah,
on Tuesdays,
I missed
Jessica Hopper could probably tell us.
I know, right? She knows everything. She's a veritable
But I love the liner notes, because if you read the liner notes of hip-hop albums, you would get to see, like, who was homies with whom, you know?
Yes.
What I mean?
Yeah.
Like,
yes, that the shout-outs.
The shout-outs. I love that. I don't know why I love that.
No, I agree, because it spoke to a community that I did not have.
Yeah.
And so it was aspirational in that sense, where if I was reading somebody else's shout-out, I'm like, I, too, might have a day where I could shout-out a community.
Right. Everyone. And it's mean? Funny. I was like...
envisioning your liner notes.
Right. And so, like, people always come up to me, or people talk to me, and they're like, man, you know, The Crown Ain't Worth Much was my first poetry book, and they're always like, man, the acknowledgments in Crown are like 3 pages long. Why did you do that? And I was like, this is
a hip hop record.
I grew up with, I mean, in my head, this is an album.
Yeah.
And I grew up reading.
Like yours were too.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
I loved that kind of thing. I loved, I remember, I love the long ones. I don't know why I remember this one in particular. I remember Fat Joe's Don Cartagena. And, the liner notes were the thank yous were just pages upon pages. You know what I mean? Because that was when, there was a lot of, crossover with the quote-unquote commercial hip-hop in the underground folks. In fact, Joe was someone who had a foot in both those worlds, and so he was thanking everyone.
Yeah.
And I remember loving that. And so...
and hip-hop is not short on props.
No.
Right? That is something that it really does a lovely job of.
It's a competitive sport at heart, but, you know.
Yeah. I haven't read liner notes.
But you let folks know if they... Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
All the shout-outs.
Yeah.
Yeah. Jessica has something to say? No? Okay.
I just want your chips.
Oh yeah.
Also, super producer DJ Cashier, if you can hear me, if you do have
a bottle opener.
Yeah, if that's a possibility, if that is a possibility.
Oh, I think there's a bottle super opener producer, coming through.
DJ Cashier,
hurry up. This is.
Any flavors on anything except for the last time I saw them, and I was like,
your chip pocket.
Jessica was gesturing, and I thought she was going to say something really insightful.
I know,
because Jessica says things insightful a lot, but it was
Do you want to eat the chips in the mic? No,
I don't think there's hot mic over here.
No, there is. I turned them up.
We just got you.
Yeah,
this is great. I love these.
I know that was my selection.
Thank you so much. I just got. This is going to sound bad, but I recently got hip to these. Because I've spent a lot of time in Phoenix the past handful of months, and these are really the move down there, and in Columbus they are not.
Yeah,
we had a lot of Latinx people.
Yeah,
here.
Does Columbus?
But only there are a lot of Mexican immigrants in Columbus, and by a lot I mean not a major part of the population, but there's a strong enclave. There are a lot of thank you.
She gives you one chip.
One chip.
It's half a chip.
So there are a lot of a full chip. There's a really dope taco truck in my neighborhood. Shout out to Junior's Tacos, but they don't sell these. They don't you know, man doesn't have these at the, so you know. This
okay,
is
so
a real,
I have a question.
Yes.
More on topic than chips, maybe. So you got into, you know, kind of critiquing music, maybe to yours personally, but did you do that before you wrote poetry?
Oh, absolutely. Thank
and
you
how did
you,
what was your your entrance into that?
The chips are actually kind of hot.
Yeah. Are they? I've really never had the Lay's ones.
Yeah.
So I was often critiquing music just to myself.
Right.
I was writing stuff. Sorry, I'm gonna cough because the chips are warm.
That's okay. Yeah, that's how you know it's real.
It is real.
Also, yeah.
I'll just eat the rest for you.
Also, we've not yet opened your jarritos, so.
I was critiquing music just to myself. I was writing books upon notebooks of what I now know as music criticism, but then just felt scrawling about.
Do you have those still?
No.
Damn, that would be amazing.
And I found myself very interested in Springsteen, and very interested in people who were telling stories.
We're making it happen. You know,
this is amazing.
No, I don't think she did.
I think
it's not enough.
We're making it happen.
Sorry.
You good?
Continue.
But I found my way into talking about music.
Super producer.
Thank you so much.
DJ Cash Era.
Do you have a DJ tag we can
Yeah, you should put it in for this specifically.
For the bottle opening. That could be the bottle opening noise.
Also, real talk, DJ Cashier is the official DJ at Louder Than a Bomb.
Where?
The illest DJ on planet Earth.
Yo.
Yeah, if you don't know, now you know. And
Also, Bulls won tonight, by the way.
Yeah, no, I know. It was a miracle.
I was with the.
We saw
that
at the corner store, actually.
I was just at the reading I was at. Jose Olivares, the homie, was We were signing books, and he was updating on his phone the Bulls score, the last minute of the Bulls game. It was wild. He wanted them to lose because
they won.
He wants to get a higher draft pick. I think they're strategy. Yeah, strategy.
They're not very good. They're
trash. Bulls app. Anyway,
shout out to the Bulls.
So, yeah, with those stacks and stacks of notebooks, I mean, in your mind, you were just writing about the music.
Yeah, I didn't know what music criticism was.
Right. But when did it? I like this.
Yeah.
Well, I think I found my voice reading other critics, and figured out what criticism was reading other critics.
Who are some of the folks you were reading?
I read Jessica. I mean, hopefully it's not embarrassing, but I've said that before. I've said that to her many times.
Just facts.
I know.
I read Jessica, but I also read, I mean, the first critic I read that I felt like was, for better or worse, speaking my language in a way that felt like the language of the fan was Lester Bangs. And I think that, and I don't remember how I stumbled upon Lester Bangs. I wish there was like a cool revelation story, but I think that I'd found his book, The Psychotic Reactions of the Carburetor, down in like a bookstore when I was in my early 20s, and loved it, and like really felt like he was writing music from the perspective of someone who loved music instead of someone who so badly wanted to dissect it to show a world how smart he was.
Mm.
And from Bang, I mean,
that's a great distinction though too.
Yeah,
you know, that you're writing for, because you're a fan, you're writing because you have love. Like, I think that's what you do. Mm-hmm. You know, is that Thanks. you do. I mean, I think you really care about what you write about. I think that's why you're also choosy about what you write about. Mm-hmm. You know, but because you're also a fan.
Yeah.
You know, as opposed to just be like, I want to flex because I'm a genius.
Yeah,
you know,
no, I want so badly for everyone to be. To gain an intense comfort with the things they love and then share those things with the world, right? I want nothing more than that. And I don't imagine that my posturing about what I know or don't know about the nuances of instrumentation, that doesn't serve many people. I love talking about music, right? I love... My friends would often get annoyed in my early 20s because we would sit in diners and bars and something would come on the jukebox and I would just ramble. But I mean, that's what I want the reading experience to feel like.
Yeah.
And so that means I want, you know what, a thing that I like always hated, right? Is that when, and you still see this now, when a black artist like samples, like when Kanye West, I remember when Kanye West started like sampling things that weren't soul, people just assumed that he had no idea what he was pulling from, right? They assumed his sample bank wasn't wide, or he didn't have the like breadth of music knowledge to pull from where he was pulling from. And that always irked me, because, and I think the thing is that, like, just because you can flex on someone doesn't mean that you have to, right? And I think that if you can sacrifice some of that in the name of serving an audience, that's important.
Yeah. That's great. I love that. So many people can learn from that, you know?
Yeah.
Non-humble ass people.
I mean, sometimes I think flexing is not even always about humility though, right?
Right.
Because you can be like pretty, sure. You can be pretty humble and still like slide in a humble flex.
No, you can.
I'm not a very good expert, I guess.
I'm more thinking of the people who have no humility, but... I don't know why you're looking at me, by the way.
I don't know why you're like dead in the eye
Kevin
when you're looking at
Cobo.
Me. But
I think a humble flex is like, I've recently rebuilt my sneaker. I have a sneaker room.
Oh, let's talk about
that,
it.
Okay. For example, was a humble
okay.
flex.
Yeah,
mentioning
that I have yeah, a exactly. Room. Yeah, there was
but
a humble flex.
Recently,
well
like,
done.
Rebuilt it and then took a picture rebuilt of it. And I was like,
humble flex.
I don't want to post this on the internet. I was going to like post it on the internet, but then I was like, this crosses a line of like humble flex to like.
How long you been a sneakerhead?
I've been a sneakerhead for ever since I was like a maybe 14 or 15.
Okay. What was the pair?
Yeah, okay, go ahead.
Sorry.
That's fine. Of course.
I'm obsessed now. So I didn't grow up with money. My parents didn't have a lot of money. And so I had to rightfully earn my first pair of sneakers. And so I remember like my family did this thing where you would do housework. You would have to fill out a contract to do housework and then you would get paid like an amount agreed on. You had to sign. It was very rigorous.
Wow.
So sure. I like saved up a lot of that money and mowed some lawns and all that. And I bought a pair of Jordan 13s. And those are not my favorite by any means, but they were the ones that came out that summer before school started. And I was like,
and everyone
well,
else had them?
Yeah. Right. It was one of those things. So that was the pair. Once I realized I could earn my own money and buy shoes, right? That was like the thing that like pushed me towards. And I didn't have a lot of money, so I had to, you know, everyone, I get that Wale is a bit of a punchline, right or wrong, but Wale has that song White Shoes that's about the significance of, in some ways, about the significance of being able to wear white shoes and not care about what happens to them because you've attained some level of you know, wealth, quote unquote, or at least
you can get another pair.
Pair, right?
And you got $90 to spend on a pair of forces.
Yeah. I actually just got back to Columbus yesterday to find out. Shout out to UPS who I'm gonna be calling in the morning. I got back to Columbus last night. I've been on book tour, so I'm bouncing around. I got back to Columbus last night to find out that a pair of kicks I ordered that were supposed to be delivered to my house are not there.
Oh,
it's
no.
And it's like,
you feel the type of way.
I feel very
shocked. I know, it's like opening the box, though.
Yeah.
My question is, what is like the threshold where you're just like a person who likes shoes and a sneakerhead? You know?
I think having a sneaker room.
That's fair.
Yeah.
You have a sneaker room, Kevin?
I have.
You have like a walk-in closet.
That, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Anyway.
That's a third bedroom. I have a problem.
Yeah, I mean, mine is also that. Yeah, my sneaker room is like my guest bedroom, but I also, the shoes kind of, I rebuilt it so that the shoes kind of like encase the bed.
So they're on the floor.
Lovely.
Yeah, no shoes on the floor.
Oh, okay.
Never.
Okay.
No, I mean, like I built some IKEA shelves.
Oh, okay.
How many pairs?
So I have 75 in the house right now. I try to not keep more than 75 in my house because.
What are the other ones? You just like have
buried in the backyard?
No, I give them away. I usually donate or like, yeah. And this kind of went through a thing where.
What are you wearing right now, though?
I'm wearing, I need to brush them off. So I like wearing the patent leather Jordans in the snow because the patent leather gets dirty, but you can just like clean them straight off.
You gotta put your foot up on the thing.
Oh, they're like dirty right now, but I'm gonna like. You can like. Oh, so the patent leather brushes off so easily.
Yeah, those are beautiful.
So easily.
Yeah.
Like, so easy. So like, when I wear these in the winter, people are like, why are you wearing those out? But it's because like, it doesn't even matter.
Those aren't the flu games. Or?
No. The flu games are the black and red ones.
Oh, okay.
I would not wear those in the winter because the black on those, like the snow and the salt would eat through that in a way that I would not be able to clean off right.
Right.
Nice. You got to pick your winter shoes carefully. I mean, I grew up in the Midwest, so like, you know.
So you are keeping some shoes clean. You don't do creases?
No.
Have you seen that meme where the guy's proposing to his girl and he takes his shoe off?
He must. I was so, I mean, of the many things that offended me about Justin Timberlake's halftime show.
Oh my God,
is
yes.
That he creased up those Jordan 3s.
Yes.
It doesn't matter to him. It doesn't matter to him.
I mean, I was offended.
I know.
Yeah, for so many reasons.
But like that performance to be that average, those Jordan 3s are delicate. You
and
know
the grass
mean?
Stains, I feel
like. You can't crease, you can crease those just like walking normally.
Right.
Justin Timberlake is out here like
bouncing around
on his tiptoes.
Dancing very slowly.
Dancing
and poorly,
like aging, you know, dancing. Yeah. Which there's nothing wrong with aging.
No.
But like,
what was with his shirt though?
I don't know. I couldn't see past the shoes. I was like so disgusted.
Yeah, didn't go with the fit either. No. It's like, come on, man.
No, it was like,
what are you doing?
Somebody compared his shirt to like a Sierra, like iOS Sierra or whatever, like the mountains.
I don't know. A lot of lumberjacks who are wearing threes is all I'm saying.
True. Yeah, sneakers are great.
When did you first get published?
Poems. Yeah, I mean, I was writing in a lot of like bad local freelance stuff in Columbus.
Yes, like, let's talk about it.
Bad, but like dear to my heart. Like,
for the local,
like local
daily,
presses, not, like
okay,
local,
like a weekly,
presses,
like the hip
mags. Yeah. Thank you, Jessica.
Give you one chip. Wow, you eat all of them? Are you sweating?
Jessica's out here dealing hot chips like the Pope or like the priest
like
at mass.
Straight edge hedonism is fucking forcing a bag of flaming
hot. That's right.
Which that's real. I feel like when you're straight edge. So I grew up. I like spent a lot of time in the punk scene, and I was not straight edge, but everyone thought I was straight edge because I don't drink or do drugs. But like all my friends drank and do drugs, so the straight edge kids hated me because they're like, "How can you hang out with them? They're like drinking a beer," and I was like, "I don't know, man."
Get off my friends.
Anyway,
I can't be like.
So yeah, like eating like Hers hot chips was my drug.
Mm.
I had several vices, but hot chips were one of them. And now I'm too old to consume them. Well, apparently, I forget what was your question. My bad.
Published.
Okay, I was like writing for like local mags and like local zines and not making a lot of money. And I got into poetry because I was being told that my style of writing about music was, at the time, this is what I was told, which is, I think it's a different thing than now, was too poetic. It was just taking too much poetic license to have people connect with it. This was like in 2011. And I was in Columbus. And it was just like, people were like, you know, I don't think your work's gonna ever break through because like you're taking too much poetic license to talk about music. Like,
what does that mean? What do they mean by that?
I think so much of my work like draws on a couple single threads and tries to spool them out really far. And people were like, well, this is no longer about the thing. And I'd be like, I know. but they were like, well, why don't you try poetry? And Columbus is poetry slam. I came up on the slam scene, and Columbus's slam scene is really rich. And what I liked about slam was that I didn't know how to write poems, right? But to enter a slam at the night I would go to, you had to bring two new poems every time. So I was just doing that so because it was like forcing me to write poems. I didn't really care about the actual slam. But when I started, there's no such thing as doing well in slam. It's a lie. It's all a lie. But when I started to quote unquote do well, I kind of followed that to a path that where it was like, oh, so I can write poems. Because in poetry, people were telling me that, at least in slam, people were telling me that my work wouldn't go over because I didn't sound like a lot of other people and because I was, you know, doing too much with imagery or like too much with narrative. So in one world I was being told I was doing something too poetically. In the other world I was being told I was doing too much narrative work. And I think that I found a way to hone those things. You know, people would give me books to read. I had, you know, poetry was new to me. I had to build my own MFA in a way. So I was telling people, like, I really want to read. Like, how can I, like, I really want to read up on stuff. How can I, like, what poems or what poets do I need to read to become better at this? And I kind of built my own.
And where did you do, you did some formal education?
Yeah, at Capital University in Columbus. But, like, I didn't study poems. And that was so, you know, like, by the time I had gotten to poems, I was far out of school, right?
Oh, so it's like, only been, like, 7 years since you started writing?
Doing poems, yeah.
Wow.
But, I mean, I spent, like, a year or several months just inside reading, you know?
And who are your, I guess, in this same question, you know, that you answered about the records, who are your people as poets? Who are you looking for and checking out and reading and drawn to?
Terrence Hayes was really important to me. Like, early on, Terrence Hayes is it. Khadijah Queen, who is still, like, deeply, deeply, deeply important to me. Adrian Matika, who's, again, also deeply important
Bars,
to me.
Yeah.
I mean, Patricia, obviously, you know, like Patricia Smith. I had gotten someone, perhaps John Sands, shout out to John Sands, had slipped me Tea House of the Almighty. And that was like my Illmatic for a long time, right? Because that was the thing I just kept returning to. And I really like kind of latched on to those four and then let them, you know, a thing that I always tell young people is like, find your favorite poets and then find out what they're reading. Right. Until you build yourself a tree, you know, you can build your own lineage if you kind of it bears mentioning that I also came up in slam at a time when I mean, the golden era of that form is like bearing fruit now. You know, I mean, I came up with Danez Smith and Sam Sachs and Franny Choi and just like endless people who are now kind of like, you know, Fatima Askar, like people who are like bearing fruit creatively, Nate Marshall, you know what I mean? Like all of these people who either were slam in slam or slam adjacent who had aspirations outside of the form. And I think that era is kind of, maybe this is a humble flex. I think that era is like fully bearing fruit now, right?
That's like a group flex.
Yeah, I mean, I think like, That's the era I came up in, right? And so, like, I wasn't just going to slams as, like, a thing. I was, like, being educated, right? You know, and that's really... I remember the first time I saw someone like Kari Jackson, you know, and being like, I can't even fathom how someone can do that. And so that was really vital, too, was that when my education did not stop when I left Columbus. You know, like when I would go to like national or regional slams, I was like also around people who were educating me through their work.
Right. And so how do you balance, I guess, then the poetry and the music criticism, journalism? I mean, how do you write prose and also cut the line? And what is your actual practice like in terms of paying attention to each? Because, you know, within a few years of each other, not only did you, you know, write and publish your first book of poems, but also then this, you know, beautiful book of essays. And then I know you're working on many other projects simultaneously. Yeah, too many. So how do you maintain that critical creative balance?
I think, so the thing I decided early on, I think I decided around the time I had started at MTV News when I was like putting the finishing touches on Crown. On The Crown Ain't Worth Much, right?
How long ago? This is 2014, 15?
No, it's 2016.
2016,
like
okay.
Like February 2016, I think. Is that when I started there?
Yes.
February 2016. And like Crown was like almost done. Crown came out in the summer of 2016. And I was like, the thing I decided then, because I was writing critically about music almost every week and also having to approach poems every week. And it just came to me that genre is, and I think we're moving this direction with music too, but I think genre is completely meaningless, or at least the like work of genre, of the writer in genre is, it mostly asks for the writer to hold themselves back from something, right? I love the James Baldwin book, The Devil Finds Work, is like this book of like film criticism, and it's like only kind of good, you know, it's like good because Baldwin can write, but it's like not the great critical work, but it doesn't matter, right? Because to him, he was just a guy who could write at the movies. And I love that approach. And I think that what I most want to imagine is that I am bringing my best writing to any writing I approach, and that's all that matters. So I don't sit down and say, I'm going to write an essay, or I'm going to write a poem. I sit down with a set of curiosities and write whatever it takes to flesh those curiosities out, right? Sometimes that takes the form of a 5,000-word essay that makes sense to me only, but sometimes it takes form in a 10-line poem. And I think there's a difference between writing to figure out your curiosities and writing to be correct at the end of them. And I think that my genre is wrongness, right? My genre is the fact that I'm wrong a lot. And my genre is not trying to be right, but to try to figure out how to create a better language for my being wrong.
Nice. Can you talk a little about what you're working on now?
Yeah, I'm working on a ton of things now. I'm working on a new poetry collection that had a title, but I think I'm going to change the title. I was just with like, it's wild because I had the title for a long time. And I was like, you know, basing the whole book off of my idea of this title. That's what I did with Crown too. I started with one poem, the title, and worked outward. And I was doing that again. And I was just recently I was like writing. My partner's also a writer. We were writing, and she was like, you know, I just don't think that's the title for this book. And I think that, like, you know, consider something different. So now I'm working on the title list. I have like a list of titles. Terrence Hayes perhaps once told me that the best way to find a title is to list all the options you have, and then before you go to bed at night, put a check next to the one you feel the best about at the end of the day. And I had done that with this first round. Now I'm thinking about doing it again. But I'm working on a new poetry collection that's rooted in this idea of I got really bummed out thinking about the way we approach, and I want to be specific and say men specifically, right? The way men approach breakup art, right? Where it's often this like kind of violent, like unfair, like thing that puts a burden on someone else who is not the artist to respond to a whole thing, right? And I didn't want to do that. And I also didn't want to like wallow in a thing. But I was interested in kind of the interior of a particular sadness that only you can have to kind of fight your way out and find language for and take ownership of. So I'm writing about that. I'm writing a lot of poems about that. I'm writing poems
just
about
like your 808s.
It's yeah,
like
exactly. Yeah. So I thought about 808s all the time, right? Yeah. I thought about 808s all the time because if no one knew what was going on in Kanye West's life at the time, of course we all know. So the album's narrative is set. But if no one knew, they would not be able to put a target on that album's sadness. And so I really fell in love with this idea of writing. So the thing people always talk about is like, oh, your work is sad. And yes, fine, sure, whatever. But I am interested, intimately interested in the idea that sadness is not just sadness, right? It's also there's it's also healing, and it's also a comfort, or it's also
and your work is also joyous. I mean, we use your work to generate celebration in our space a lot at YCA too.
Yeah,
you know, I mean, your work also speaks to, you know, odes and you know, pedestalizing things in your life that you want to be recognized and
yeah.
holding them up, you know.
And that's what I was thinking about with this joint, is that like I'm writing poems where I am trying to pedestalize the version of myself I hope to attain, right? After at the end of whatever this like moment I went through was, and I wanted to do it only by holding myself accountable and not making a piece of art that asks someone else to be held accountable for things. So I'm working on a new collection of poems, a lot of like weird work in the voice of Marvin Gaye's Ghost, a lot of weird poems about Nikola Tesla, stuff like that.
And at the same time?
Same time, I'm working on a book about A Tribe Called Quest.
Yes! Yeah. I read the book proposal.
Oh, did you?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, that's right. I heard.
Yeah.
I heard.
Yes.
So I'm doing that. That's
significant.
Due in, the yeah, draft of that tight. Is due in like 5 days.
Oh,
so.
Wow.
Fuck it up.
So hopefully that works. It's fine. I have like one chapter draft left, and I have to watch the documentary to do it. So I just have to like find time at home to like rewatch the documentary.
Great.
But it's been fun. It's involved a lot of like weird digging in the crates research, you know, and a lot of like. A lot of like interesting coming to terms with the fact. The weird thing about Tribe is that because of my, you know, interest in not loving the main person in a group and loving the other one, I loved Fife. I didn't love Q-Tip.
My brother too. Same.
Loved Fife.
Yeah.
And because of that, I imagined Fife's role is so massive in the group when I was young, which it was particularly on like Midnight Marauders, I think.
So that was a natural inclination to just like pay attention to not the yeah. leading man.
But then I went back and I was like, man, Fife was only on like 3 cuts on the first album.
Yeah.
Like
yeah.
maybe 3 or 4.
Yeah.
And on the second, like on Low End Theory, he's kind of there, but it's definitely a Q-Tip album. And it's a little heartbreaking that I think the great Fife album is Beats, Rhymes, and Life, right? It's the great, that's the album that
the Tribe it's not
album,
the great,
it's
tribe,
not the great tribe album.
Yeah.
And I think that's the thing with Fife, right? Is that.
Although you could, I mean, I think even on Low End though, you could make the case that Fife is also a star, if not of the entire, yeah. like on the joints where they are toe for toe, you know, that Fife is more than holding his own.
Oh, yeah,
like
he
yeah, yeah.
I mean, Low End is the album where I think every band or every group with more than like 2 people in it has a point where everything converges in the album is, you know, I think I'm a shout out to, we're in Chicago, I'm a Fall Out Boy fan, or was.
I know, you write about it in the Book of Essays extensively.
Extensively.
Yeah.
But Infinity on High was that album where everything came together for them, right? Like Pete's writing.
You're from
was
Chicago?
There. Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Pete's writing was there, and Patrick, like, his singing took it to the next level, and the like, drumming was there. And so I think Low End is that thing. But it kind of hurts me a little bit.
You
that
just
like,
compared Fall Out Boy to. Never mind.
Look,
that's
I mean,
crazy.
Look, he's fluid,
no, I've never
man.
Heard
that's
anyone.
What it is.
Yeah, that's
yeah,
dope.
That's why.
But
he's,
I think every group
here.
Has that album, and Low End was the album. Well, I mean, that's why Low End is a classic, right? It's the album where everything came together.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
then kind of like everything after Low End was just like a slow unraveling, right? Like Midnight Marauders is good, but not. It's very good, but not like great. Mm. And then Beats, Rhymes, and Life is like really like. Less than great, and then Low End is, or not Low End, but Love Movement is kind of like
a little,
you know,
sad, maybe
a little bit sad,
a little bit,
yeah.
And when is that book due out?
That book is due out early next year.
Okay.
So I'm on a kind of track where ideally that book comes out early next year. The poetry book comes out in fall next year.
Uh-huh.
Wow.
So you just stay on the road.
Stay on the road. Well, hopefully not. The Tribe book, I don't think I'm gonna have to travel a lot for. I hope not.
Because why?
Well, because I just want to be home.
Okay. Good luck.
Yeah. I mean, I would love to talk about Tribe, but...
You didn't do a lot of interviews for that book, right?
I didn't.
Yeah.
No. So I don't think I'm going to have to do a lot. But who knows?
Yeah.
The poetry book, too. We'll see. I think I can, like, condense this. Maybe I can't. I don't know. I oftentimes look at my schedule and think, how did I arrive here? As someone who likes to be home, I think I just want to write enough books to where I can become a recluse.
Yeah.
Live at home.
That sounds nice.
You just did another book deal. Ask
I just signed
and another book deal. It
oh, I wasn't
stop.
Sure if we were allowed to ask.
Oh
no, you're allowed to ask.
Okay, what? It's yeah, public, thanks, Jessica
okay.
Hopper.
Yeah.
yeah. What is the other?
Our peanut gallery over
deal?
Here.
Right. So I'm over here, mom. It's a good like stage mom thing.
yeah. And he's got another book. Don't
got
don't.
No,
it's
going to
be really big.
Two. Yeah, it's a 2-book deal.
2-book deal.
I signed a 2-book deal at Random House, which is two books. So the first book is going to be I took a break. I went on vacation at the end of last year. But what that meant, because I'm always traveling, to me, vacation means like just chilling in my apartment, which was great. Chilling in my apartment with like no deadlines and no responding to emails, you know, just like.
What is that?
Writing for fun. You know, like when I went to go write, for example, when I went to write They Can't Kill Us, I went to Provincetown late last year. In Provincetown in the winter is like a ghost town. And I secluded myself for like a month and came out with that. And I was like, I don't want to do that again. I just want to write freely. And so I was like writing these. I was doing a bunch of like weird vignettes about minstrel shows and the history of kind of comparing minstrel acts or comparing acts of black performance. Like I wrote this little thing about Bernie Mac and Mike Tyson. And I wrote this very long thing about Justin Timberlake and Al Green and Isaac Hayes, and particularly the Cadillac that Isaac Hayes had taken from him that sits in the Stax Museum now, but he got taken from him when he went bankrupt. So I wrote this long thing about black performance and possessions as a means to show what they have earned. I was, you know, thinking about ways to stretch that into a book because I have so many thoughts about minstrel shows and minstrelly. And I was thinking about Little Brother too. I wrote like a little thing about Little Brother in their album, The Minstrel Show. And Random House was very excited about that idea. I met with them on the day after New Year's and they were like, we want that book. And I was like, great. And then they were like, we want another book. And I was like, well, cool. You know what I mean? Like, but I don't know. The other book is just going to be another book of essays in the vein of They Can't Kill Us, I think.
To be named later. Yeah.
I think they have a vision. They kept throwing around this idea. They were just like, well, you can be like our like Chuck Klosterman. And I was like, well,
I'm going to be me.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know if I want to be.
No disrespect to Chuck
Klosterman. Yeah. But be you. Well, I guess, you know, just who are some of the folks that now you're continuing to seek out, look for, some of the folks that now who you're reading or listening to even that you're inspired by?
Music-wise? Poetry-wise?
Anything.
Yeah.
TV?
I really want to start a thing in which I'm most inspired by my direct peers, right? I mean, you know, Eve Ewing is my sister and the work we do, and I love her deeply and would not be able to create without her just like encouragement. And there was a point when I was working on that book where I would not have been able to create at all without Eve. You know, like I wrote that book or a lot of the essays in that book during like a very, very difficult time, right? And so there is a world in which that book doesn't exist if Eve isn't texting me like, have you eaten? You know what I mean? Like just basic stuff like that. I am very interested in the work of poets like Cam Awkward Rich, and I am, you know, Jose's new work is just really doing a lot at the intersection of love and anger, like a righteous anger that's it's doing a lot of work about seeing your way through righteous anger to still find ways to love, and I think that is immensely inspiring for me. I really love, so my favorite poet, maybe this is wild because no one is hip to her, I love Angela Veronica Wong. I have loved Angela Veronica Wong's poems since like 2013. I am such a stan that I sometimes like will just like Google her and then like do the like search tools and put it like past week or month to see if I've missed a poem that's gotten published. Cause she's not like she's not like out here, but I love her work. I read her work all the time. Vanessa Angelica Villarreal just put out a book called Beast Meridian that I loved so much last year, at the end of last year. Justin Philip Reed's book Indecency is coming out in like a couple months and I love it. I got like a galley copy, which I don't always get, so I'm always hype about those. And Human Wind, new joints coming out a couple months and I love it. So just like my direct peers I feel most pushed by because they're the ones who are like rejecting the canon that we were taught. Right, they're rejecting that. These are the ones who like came up reading poems in bars, or these are the ones who dropped out of MFA programs, or these are the ones who learned to love poetry because they got handed a book by someone, you know. Which is like no disrespect to the canon, as I understand it, because my canon is not the canon, capital C.
Yeah, it's your canon.
But I love my peers because all of us came up in these really disparate ways and found our ways to work differently, and I think that we are pushing each other with that in mind. What am I listening? I mean, I listen to music. It's so weird when people are like, what are you listening to? Because it's like an impossible question to answer because I pretty much, you know who I decided I've been into? I decided I like Jaden Smith. It took me a long time to figure out what was working for me, what was working with Jaden Smith for me. But I think I like Jaden Smith.
I love that ASAP what about him, record. Yeah.
Well, I think the thing about Jaden Smith is that he, what interests me about Jaden Smith is that he demands more questions and answers out of a listener and out of a viewer with his, because he's so deeply. He's a child of a very specific era of Kanye West, right? Like, I think we've, like, breezed past the children of the college dropout era Kanye West, and Jaden Smith is kind of like a graduation-esque child of that era, which means he's, by default, I think, if we're talking about building lineage, he's kind of, by default, like a Cuddy kid, yeah. You know? Like, that was
a lot of them.
That was an unfortunate
one. Nice.
But he's like a child of Cuddy, right? And I'm so hype about this younger generation of kind of eccentric, whatever the heck that means. I don't know if I can curse, so I said heck.
Oh, no, you can't.
Oh, yeah. Sorry.
Record low cusses.
I think I said
on
F word.
I was
like,
so worried. I just want listeners to know I would never say heck in real life.
Hecky like, nah is appropriate for Chicago.
Yeah, hecky nah is appropriate for Chicago. Yeah. I just saw Nate Marshall read at Denison in Ohio, and he did that. He has a poem about the word, the hecky nah, which was really cool. And so, yeah, I'm excited by this era of kind of like eccentric, whatever the fuck that means. Folks who came of age during this, like Cuddy. Shout out to Cuddy, by the way, Ohioan.
Yeah, like, that's true.
One of the finest. Which, by the way, Cuddy and Machine Gun Kelly came out of Cleveland at about kind of really the same time. And what a fascinating career arc for both of them.
Oh, my God.
If you were, like, in Ohio when both of them were coming out.
Did that make sense?
It made sense. Wow. Right? It made a lot of sense. But I don't think anyone predicted that their careers would go in the two different ways they went. I think people saw Cuddy as, like, I mean, Machine Gun Kelly now is, like, you know, I saw him recently. He's got electric guitars, and he's, like,
of course,
singing, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I don't think I've ever really listened to him.
Yeah,
no, yeah, never really.
It's kind of got to go that way. But Cuddy, I think, was, like, I think Cuddy, at the time he's coming out, people imagine him as kind of a real lyricist, which in some ways he is, but I think people imagine
he was
like a real gutter lyricist.
Yeah.
And Machine Gun Kelly was supposed to be this like kind of white heir to the Bone Thugs and Harmony Throne. Mm. And they've both kind of like taken these weird ways. But I say to say I'm learning to like Jaden Smith. I really like Sampha. I was listening to Magic Jordan in my car the other day, driving through Boston yesterday in the rain, and I was like, this is perfect. I think I'm learning more now about what a mood is asking out of my listening experience, as opposed to trying to fit a listening experience into the mood. I'm very good at making playlists for people, but I think that like so the act of making a playlist is a generous act, and I think sometimes, or maybe too often, people imagine it as a selfish act, you know, or like people approach it selfishly, when really it's an act of like blatant, like eager, almost grotesque generosity, you know?
Yeah, well, like your writing. I mean, you know, to be honest, I mean,
oh,
like,
very kind.
No, but it's true. I mean, I think that, you know, that is what you're doing. You know, you stay putting people on, and I think,
yeah,
you know, the world is better for it. You know, where can people find you on the interconnected networks?
All my social media is the same. It's just, it's Neef Muhammad. So, which is, I didn't think this out when I first got my Twitter name, but it's just NIFMUHAMMAD. That's like Twitter and Instagram. I tweet probably too much and like too much about like food
and basketball. Yeah. Good amount.
Yeah, it's a good amount. I think like people won't post. I do tweet about like writing sometimes, but I also want people to know that I'm like a full whole person. You know what I mean?
Right. Yeah,
like,
right. I have other interests, y'all.
Who like writes alone? Writing is such a lonely thing. You know what I mean? Like I write alone often, just in front of my computer, and so it's great to be able to interact on some shit that's not writing. I didn't know I could have been cursing this whole time. How unfortunate!
Oh damn!
Yeah, just get them all out right now.
But then it's like crass. And there's like, you know.
Yeah.
I don't know. We all about being crass here.
Well, hey, amen. We really appreciate you taking the time. I know you had a reading tonight and you got a very early ass flight tomorrow.
I do have an early flight. It's not because I don't love it here. I wish I could stay.
You should. Well, you come back.
I'm coming back in like a month. I'm doing a thing with Jessica.
Okay.
Oh.
Are you doing
okay.
that thing at Women and Children?
Oh, yeah. I think so. Yeah.
Good. Well, people should check for that.
Check for that.
And for real, like you know, They Can't Kill Us Until They Kill Us is a beautiful collection of essays. The poems are brilliant, and excited, so excited for the future book. So thanks, man. Thanks for spending time with us tonight. For real.
Thanks for the hostess cake.
Oh yeah, for sure.
Hey, thank you, DJ Exhibit, for the beat.
Langston Olsen for the logo and art.
Big up, WGN Radio. Shout out to our super producer, DJ Cash Era.
And boss man, Todd Manley.
Thank you, Dami.
And Marlena, the snack provider.
Shout out, Rena, the official photog in the corner store.
Stay up with us, Shy Corner Store, on Instagram, Twitter, and SoundCloud.
And please, y'all, please rate and subscribe on iTunes, Apple Music, SoundCloud, and wherever you listen to a podcast. Consider giving us those 5 stars.
And tell a friend.
And thank you for listening and rocking with us. We'll see you next week.